that satanic pedophiles are coming after your children in the form of drag queens. And then the Maestrianos of the world and the Donald Trumps of the world sort of foster and sanitize that seed and grow it for their audiences. And then the Proud Boys and other extremists show up in force to burn it all to the ground. I mean, Maestriano follows Trump on a lot of rhetoric, and so his success, you know, shows that we are not moving away at all from the extremist contingent. And in fact, the Republican Party appears to be doubling down on it going forward.
Andy Campbell, we just have a minute. You have spent a long time now writing this book, We Are Proud Boys, How a Right-Wing Street Gang Ushered in a New Era of American Extremism. What most shocked you in your research and the GOP also normalizing the political violence issue?
After January 6th, the fact that the Proud Boys only ramped up their violence over the years, and the fact that the GOP only embraced them more, that was surprising to me. The fact that they didn't dissolve shows not only their resiliency as a group, but it shows where we are headed in the future of politics. Political violence is normalized for the right, and again, voters are going to have to decide whether this is what we want going forward.
January 6th insurrection becoming legitimate political discourse. What are you expecting from Wednesday, the next public hearing of the January 6th committee?
I think the committee has done a great job of surfacing the problem, this extremist crisis we have. But I also think that we are 10 steps behind with our leadership and with our law enforcement on responding to the crisis. And so I'm hoping that there is a culture shift over the next few years where we are not just understanding the problem, but responding to it.
Andy Campbell, thanks so much. Senior editor at HuffPost, the new book, We Are Proud Boys, How a Right-Wing Street Gang Ushered in a New Era of American Extremism.
You're listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM and streaming online at kboo.fm.
Prison Pipeline is a radio program dedicated to educating the public about the Oregon criminal justice system. Topics include incarceration and reentry, addictions and mental health, elections and laws, victims' rights, and criminal justice reform. The program presents a unique understanding of the criminal justice system, addresses the root causes of crime, and challenges the status quo. It seeks to promote awareness and activism in order to foster a safer, healthier, and more just society.
Prison Pipeline airs on Monday evenings from 6:30 to 7 p.m. on KBOO Portland. Check us out every week. If you miss an episode, you can stream it later. Just go to kboo.fm/prisonpipeline. More info about upcoming shows and events related to the prison community can be found on our Facebook page, Prison Pipeline. Be sure to like us.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with the requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available at our website at kboo.fm. Due to the temporary closure of in-station activity at KBOO, board meetings will be conducted online via public video conferencing unless otherwise noted. A public link and phone number to attend the meetings are available on our website. The KBOO Board of Directors meets the fourth Monday of the month starting at 6 p.m. Please visit our website at kboo.fm to verify if a meeting is being held.
The KBOO Evening News produces a nightly one-hour newscast every weekday night. We need writers, editors, reporters, and more to make this grassroots community resource happen. Are you interested? Would you like to try something exciting? Training in writing for radio, interviewing, field recording, and audio editing is all free of charge. But you have to go through the KBOO volunteer orientation first. For more information, email newsdirector@kboo.org.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, Portland Mayor Ted Wheeler endorses a controversial pilot program to address gun violence. The New York Times reveals a scheme by Providence Hospitals to illegally squeeze funds from the poorest patients. And the Lummi Nation takes a totem pole across the U.S. for environmental justice. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Monday, September 26th, 2022. I'm Michelle Coppola. Portland Mayor Ted Wheeler is planning to bring a controversial new police technology to the city in the form of hidden microphones listening for gunshots. It's a company called ShotSpotter, and he announced his intentions to the Focused Intervention Team Community Oversight Group on Thursday. That group recommended that the city adopt the technology in July, and now Wheeler plans to bring a pilot program to the city council for approval. ShotSpotter says they can identify and locate gunshots in real time by monitoring small hidden cameras on buildings and telephone poles. Police can then use that data to investigate crime. It's no secret that Portland is facing a gun violence crisis. As of last week, there have been 958 shootings in 2022, which have injured 290 people. Portland has had 66 homicides so far this year as well, 57 of which involved guns. The city has taken other actions to mitigate this, like Wheeler reintroducing cops patrolling Old Town on weekend nights and special police teams focused specifically on gun violence. They have yet, however, to reverse the trend. A New York Times investigation has revealed that one of the West Coast's largest nonprofit hospital systems, Providence, has illegally hounded patients for money when they were eligible for free care. Evidence compiled by reporters and by lawyers in a number of lawsuits against the hospital show that Providence trained their employees to push low-income patients to pay for medical care, even when it violated state laws. In 2018, Providence executives realized that the free health care it was offering to patients was cutting into their bottom line. They implemented a program called Rev Up to get employees to put pressure on low-income patients to pay for care. They would send debt collectors after those people who qualified for free treatment, sometimes cratering their credit scores or forcing people to give up some groceries. Staff were instructed to say, "How will you be paying today?" instead of asking if folks were able. Training told staff to never accept the first no they got from a patient. Providence is a multi-billion dollar nonprofit. Last year, their revenue was over $27 billion. Providence enjoys billions in tax breaks because of its nonprofit status. Before the program to boost revenue started, 1.25% of their expenses were spent on charity care. The Lummi Nation has sent a totem pole to the East Coast as a way to call for environmental justice as the country transitions to cleaner energy sources. Eric Tegetoff has more on the journey.
A totem pole from the Lummi Nation in Northwest Washington is traveling across the country as part of a bid to call for clean energy and environmental justice. The pole left the Lummi Reservation in mid-September and has made stops along the way, including in Seattle, George Floyd Plaza in Minneapolis, and in Pittsburgh, which hosted a ministerial meeting on clean energy last week. Douglas James is with Lummi Nation's House of Tears Carvers, which crafted the 14-foot totem pole, and is traveling with it across the country.
We're just standing up for those that don't have a voice, like the birds, the frogs, the salmon, the orcas.
The totem pole is scheduled to reach Washington, D.C. this week. James says the Lummi Nation first dedicated a totem pole to victims of September 11th 2 decades ago. Wes Gillingham with Catskill Mountain Keeper in New York is traveling with the totem pole as well. He's critical of some alternative fuel sources being proposed, such as what's known as green hydrogen, which has a reduced carbon footprint but still produces emissions. He says indigenous people should be at the forefront in the transition to clean energy.
Listen to the voices of indigenous leaders and communities that have been impacted historically. They are working on finding some of their own solutions, organic or sustainable agriculture, to help reduce the emissions from the agricultural industry and industrialization of agriculture that's taken place over the last 50 years.
James believes it will take a monumental effort to beat climate change and ensure clean air and water for the next generation.
It's going to take every one of us, everybody that's living and breathing upon this planet, to try and do the best that we can to stand and make a difference.
For Washington News Service, I'm Eric Tegedoff.
Two-thirds of voters say that this midterm election is more important than past elections. With that story and more, it's Mary Sherman with 2022 Talks.
Welcome to 2022 Talks, where we're following our democracy in historic times.
There's 59 toss-up races. 43 of those are held by Democrats, just 16 by Republicans. So just the math, even if those seats sort of broken in a more even way or a lesser way for Republicans, just seems more likely they'll make up those seats to come back and take control of Congress.
Republican pollster Brian Nienaber says he still expects the GOP to win the House this fall, despite a recent decline in their poll numbers. The Senate also looks close, but more likely to stay Democratic. A new Washington Post ABC News poll found two-thirds of voters believe casting a ballot this year is more important than in previous elections, which could mean higher than usual turnout. The poll also found just a third of Democrats want President Biden to run in 2024. Meanwhile, Democratic pollster Nancy Zadunkowicz says the Supreme Court Dobbs decision is motivating a lot of Democrats, especially women.
Also, there's been a string of wins, the resurrection of the Biden legislative agenda and things like student loan forgiveness. They've really helped the Democratic Party come together. But more than anything, I think it's been drawing a contrast with Republicans.
The Dobbs decision overturned Roe versus Wade and put abortion policies in the hands of states. The CEO of a Southern California Planned Parenthood says they're already seeing a lot of patients from other states. Stacy Cross says severe restrictions and bans means women are flooding into their clinic in Marmonte for help.
In 18 states, women and people seeking abortions are second-class citizens in the United States of America, and that should send a chill down your back.
Reproductive rights groups are expected to appeal a court ruling that allows an Arizona law to prohibit nearly all abortions. The law from 1864 had been blocked since 1973. The White House condemned the ruling, saying it sets women back more than a century. New York City Mayor Eric Adams plans to construct hangar-sized tents as temporary shelter for thousands of migrants transported to the city by Republican border state governors. Recent polls suggest voters are split on whether they approve or disapprove of migrants being sent to liberal states and cities. Migration Policy Institute President Andrew Seeley says most migrants coming to the southern border are still from Mexico and Central America. But he says migration from Venezuela, Cuba, and Nicaragua is complicated by U.S. policies favoring refugees from the political and economic crises in those communist nations.
You can't actually deport people back, which means if they make it to the U.S.-Mexico border, they are likely almost certain to be able to stay in the United States.
The White House is planning to launch a refugee sponsorship program by the end of the year to enlist private groups and citizens to sponsor and resettle refugees. In fiscal 2021, more than 11,000 refugees were resettled through the traditional resettlement program, short of the White House goal of about 62,000. I'm Mary Sherman for Pacifica Network and Public News Service. Find our trust indicators to support transparency and accuracy at publicnewsservice.org.
A new report highlights inequity in end-of-life care for Latinos, African Americans, and LGBTQ elders. Advocates urge families to have conversations about end-of-life care before the time comes. Suzanne Potter has more on that story.
Latinos and other underserved communities face persistent inequities in end-of-life care, according to a new report from Compassion and Choices and the National Hispanic Council on Aging. The report, which comes out during Hispanic Heritage Month, finds the disparities stem from a lack of financial resources, discrimination, and a dearth of providers from those communities. Patricia Gonzalez-Portillo with Compassion and Choices says Latinos in particular sometimes tend to harbor distrust in the medical system, which can be a barrier to care.
We have the history of not having the information that's culturally sensitive or appropriate. That's why at Compassion and Choices, we have these materials available in a cultural appropriate manner in their language, in Spanish and English.
The report recommends increased training for medical providers on end-of-life care planning and urges medical and nursing schools and other supportive practitioner programs to make a concerted effort to recruit and retain diverse candidates. The study also noted inequities for people with disabilities and among those in the African American, LGBTQ+, Asian American, Native Hawaiian, Pacific Islander, and Native American communities. Gonzalez Portillo encourages everyone to have that difficult conversation with doctors and family about advance directives and end-of-life wishes.
When we are expecting a baby, we prepare for the baby. You know, our death is something that's also going to happen to all of us, and we need to prepare for that.
The Hispanic community in America represents 60 million Latinos, or 1 in 5 residents. In California, they make up the largest population group at almost 40%. For California News Service, I'm Suzanne Potter.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for Making Contact. At 6 p.m., it's Labor Radio. At 6:30, Prison Pipeline. Then at 7, Hard Knock Radio. Your weather forecast, boy, we are having a beautiful fall. It's going to be clear tonight with an overnight low of 60. Tomorrow, mostly sunny and a high of 80. Today in history, in 1981, American professional tennis player Serena Williams was born. Williams is widely considered one of the greatest tennis players of all time. She claimed 23 Grand Slam titles in her career, the most by any player in the modern era. The quote of the day is from Serena Williams, who said, "Think of all the girls who could become top athletes but quit sports because they're afraid of having too defined muscles and being made fun of or called unattractive." Elections are just 6 weeks away, and Texas is in the thick of controversy once again for the sheer number of election deniers on the ballot this November. The National Task Force on Election Crises is monitoring threats that may emerge through voting, counting, and certification processes. Roz Brown has more.
Ahead of the November midterms, the Texas Secretary of State outlined details last week for a campaign aimed at educating voters before the November election, noting there will be more oversight. Governor Greg Abbott approved an elections bill last year that bans 24-hour polling places, tightens ID requirements, and limits drive-through and voting by mail. Wendy Weiser with the Brennan Center for Justice warns new tactics, such as candidates claiming election fraud, even if they win, could lead to an election crisis.
We think that brief candidates can and should use all of the procedures available to them under the law and review election outcomes, but we need to do a lot to reinforce the norm of accepting the results of a valid election.
According to the political website 538, Texas has more 2020 election deniers running for U.S. House or statewide office than any other state, with 201 of 552 Republican candidates convinced President Joe Biden did not win in 2020. Jennifer Morrell with consulting firm The Elections Group says she recently visited with election officials in Austin and found them exhausted.
So I think it's imperative that we acknowledge that these professionals, while continuing to uphold the oaths they've taken and administer elections in a transparent and bipartisan way, are not working in a normal environment. They're not operating under ideal circumstances.
Morrell says ultimately elections are a human process and worries that even a minor glitch in November could lead to charges that Texas elections are not fair.
My fear is that an innocent mistake or even something more normal like long lines or the delayed opening of a polling location will somehow be used to further undermine the work of these election professionals.
Training to be a poll watcher in Texas requires a certificate of completion from the Texas Secretary of State's office. In-person early voting in Texas starts on October 24th and continues until November 4th. Election Day is the following Tuesday, November 8th. For Texas News Service, I'm Roz Brown.
Environmental groups are calling on state and federal leaders to halt the Suncor Line 1 Rocky Mountain Pipeline project in Colorado. They cite concerns about air and water pollution and how it would impact communities of color. Eric Galatas has more on the pushback.
More than 40 environmental groups are urging federal regulators and Colorado's congressional delegation to put a pause on a pipeline project underway in Weld County called Line 1 that would nearly triple the current capacity to deliver crude oil to the Suncor refinery in Commerce City. Patricia Garcia-Nelson with the group Green Latinos says if officials allow the extension of Line 1 to continue, they essentially will be rewarding bad behavior.
Suncor has a history of being a problematic operator. They violated pollution limits. They had been operating under an expired permit since 2011.
Last week, the group sent formal petitions to federal regulators warning that the project will increase greenhouse gas emissions and the toxic burden on an already heavily polluted community living near the refinery. The pipeline will cross the South Platte River, which supplies water for eastern Colorado and downstream states, and a 100-year floodplain. Suncor says it has no plans to increase capacity with the new pipeline and argues it will reduce emissions from trucks carrying crude. Garcia-Nelson argues the project will undermine Colorado's efforts to meet climate targets and realize goals in the Colorado Environmental Justice Act passed by lawmakers last year. She notes that in the United States, more than 17 million people currently live near oil and gas facilities.
And 1.6 million of those people are Latinos. When we take even a closer look at Suncor, when we look at the communities around there, there's mostly Black, Brown, Indigenous people of color.
Because Line 1 replaces an existing pipeline, the project is going forward without public input on its potential impacts on communities, air and water quality, and climate change. But Garcia-Nelson says that won't stop her group and others from trying to stop it.
Without the normal public comment pieces, the decision is taken out of the residents' hands that are going to be directly impacted by this expansion.
This is Eric Galatas reporting for the Colorado News Connection.
Scientists have mapped hidden waterways under the city of Naples. Researchers with the Cool Cities Project believe the water could be used to cool that city. Dr. Anthony Lizowitz has more on the story with Climate Connections.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lizowitz, and this is Climate Connections. A vast network of waterways lies hidden under Naples, Italy, including aqueducts that were built when the ancient Greeks colonized the area.
They are waterways or aqueducts that were constructed during that period and also during Roman times. There are also streams and other waterways that were developed over time to guide the watershed. So it's kind of a world of water there.
Nick DePace is a collaborator with the Cool Cities Project. His team is using laser technology to map the hidden waterways under Naples.
That water is not refuse. That water coming from high streams and from Roman aqueducts and so forth could be rerouted and reused for the sake of cooling the city rather than being thrown directly into a wastewater system.
Cities heat up faster than the surrounding region because buildings and streets absorb heat. But trees, plants, and water provide cooling. So adding parks and features such as fountains could help make the city cooler as the climate warms. DePace says the water available under the city could be brought to the surface and used for cooling. And the Cool Cities Mapping Project is laying the groundwork.
So it's basically a matter of identifying and coveting those water resources.
Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. To hear more stories like this, visit climateconnections.org.
President Biden has declared a federal disaster for Alaska's storm damage. With that story and more, it's Antonia Gonzalez with National Native News.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. The Biden administration on Friday approved a request from Alaska's governor for a federal disaster declaration after a powerful storm battered more than 1,000 miles of coastline in the northernmost state last weekend. The declaration frees up funding through the Federal Emergency Management Agency to aid in storm recovery. As Emily Schwing reports, more than 40 Alaska Native communities are now facing a serious threat to their food security.
In at least two communities, dozens of residents have been displaced after their homes were ripped from their foundations by floodwater. The storm surge included hurricane-force winds that also destroyed boats people rely on for both transportation and hunting and fishing. Ryan Bukowski is one of nearly 1,000 residents in the village of Chivac.
I mean, even the people that go out
with working boats right now, that's not even enough to feed the community with what subsistence food that they need that they haven't already lost due to power outage.
Bukowski and many other Alaskans lost power for days after the storm. Without electricity, the freezers where many people store all their fish, meat, and berries, and other locally harvested foods for winter have thawed. Lots of that food is now spoiled. Dozens of hunting and fishing camps central to the subsistence lifestyle observed by many residents in rural Alaska were also damaged or destroyed. For National Native News, I'm Emily Schwing.
Communities of color remain consistently affected by COVID-19 at higher rates than whites. That's according to an Oregon Health Authority review. KLCC's Brian Bull reports.
OHA's latest year-in-review report shows that in both 2020 and 2021, Black, Native American, and Latinx Oregonians suffered higher rates of hospitalizations and death than whites. Researchers list lack of access to health care, lower-income jobs, crowded workspaces, and distrust in government as factors. Kelly Rouse, the executive director of health services for the Confederated Tribes of the Grand Ronde. She says OHA's finding matches what she's seen this year as well.
We are still having fairly high rates of COVID infection out at Grand Ronde. Right after the holiday Labor Day weekend, mostly BA.5, this most recent variant is incredibly infectious. You know, the congregating people, it really rose pretty significantly.
OHA says data on race was available for 73% of all reported cases last year. For National Native News, I'm Brian Bull.
California Governor Gavin Newsom signed a package of five tribal bills on Friday. One requires state agency leaders to take training, improve communication, and interact with tribes on government-to-government issues. The second one creates a feather alert system for missing and murdered Indigenous people. It's similar to those used in cases of abducted children. The third encourages schools and county offices to engage with tribes in their area and provide accurate education about Native history and culture. The fourth bill authorizes the University of California Hastings College of Law to remove the name of its founder who slaughtered tribal people in the 1800s and rename the school with tribal input. The fifth bill requires the renaming of California geographic features, landmarks, public lands, and structures that use the SQ word by January 1st, 2024. All five bills were authored by Native American lawmaker James Ramos. The governor signed the package of bills on California Native American Day. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News for Monday, September 26th, 2022. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news stories and tips. We certainly appreciate them. You can do that at 971-245-2158. Our producer for tonight's newscast is Althea Billings. Our engineer is Otto. And special thanks to Eric Tegetoff, Antonia Gonzalez, Suzanne Potter, Eric Galatas, Roz Brown, Mary Sherman, and Dr. Anthony Lizawitz. The director of Evening News is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Michelle Coppola, and coming up tomorrow morning on KBOO at 8 a.m., it's Too Much Information with Abe and Tracy, talking current events and taking listener calls. At 9, Alternative Radio features lectures and interviews with progressive thinkers. At 10, it's Flashpoints with Dennis Bernstein. Then at 11, it's Times Like Now with host Trevor Collins. Stick around at 11:30 for Art Focus, where host Joseph Gallivan interviews curator Olivia Miller about the art of food at the Jordan Schnitzer Museum of Art at PSU that is running through December 3rd. All of these KBOO programs, including the evening news, are made possible by support from our members. If you'd like to become a member, we certainly would appreciate it. Please support our programming by going to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. Stay tuned now for Making Contact. Have a great night.
Howdy, everybody. I'm Rose Maddox, and I'd like to tell you that you're listening to KBOO in Portland, Oregon, the station that I listen to when I'm in the area.
Our system is, in too many ways, broken.
The way we see the world shapes the way that we treat it.
This is Making Contact.
I'm Salima Hamarani, and on today's Making Contact...
I am now working in agriculture with our Arab, Spanish, Indian, and Filipino brethren.
We hear from our friends at the podcast Kerning Cultures about a Yemeni immigrant who joined the United Farm Workers in the 1970s.
Working in the grape fields is tougher than coal mining, because the work is for longer hours, and the workers are exposed to maltreatment by the greedy capitalist landowners.
His name was Naji Daifala, and he became one of the